talking.
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Is the mic on? Well, I want to welcome everyone to the carbon management track here at the annual Bay Planning Coalition meeting. And I think, I hope you find we've assembled a truly exceptional set of two panels here this morning. I'll be facilitating the first section as noted in your program, and my fellow moderator, Chris Locke, will be moderating the second session this morning. And the way we structured it here today is we're going to provide each speaker with a few minutes just for some introductory remarks. I'll set the context a little, and then each of the panelists will have about 5 minutes to present some messages about what they've been up to in relation to carbon emission regulation. And then we're going to have a Q&A session after that. We should have, for this first session, about a half hour available. The second session will then come up. They'll have their own Q&A, but we're hoping at the end to have a combined session where a Q&A session for all the panelists involved in today's sessions. When it comes time for Q&A, I think there's to be a microphone. They're setting up right now in the middle of the room. So please come down and participate by joining the dialogue, asking questions. As Ellen stated earlier, the conversation is this conference. It's a different and new format, and I think a very exciting format for this year's Bay Planning Coalition meeting. It's very rare I get to sit here and speak rather than standing up at a podium. There will be no introduction of the panelists. I'll give a brief introduction of their name, but their biographies of these very great set of panelists we have today are in your program book. And I'll just start off a little bit with setting the context. If you can put my slide up, please. That was me. As mentioned in our earlier speaker's discussion, despite some of the news on all the emails and who hacked which emails and what those emails said, really the science debate, especially in the minds of many of the policymakers and regulators, is over. They're really moving toward what can be done to help control and reduce carbon emissions. Usually when I give talks related to carbon emissions, I ask the audience, which way would you prefer to have carbon regulations? Would you want it to be via legislation, litigation, or regulation? As many of you are aware, there is litigation or legislation within the U.S. Congress. The Waxman-Markley bill did pass the House. The Senate is considering it, debating it, discussing it. The last news I heard is because there's going to be a new Supreme Court nominee to debate all summer, that it's less likely that the Senate will get around to debating and passing a climate bill before the next election. But you never know. There's a new story every day on where the Senate is with that bill. So legislation-wise, new legislation-wise, maybe not anything this year, maybe something next year. Litigation, I think Chris may talk a little bit more about this when he opens his session. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to talk about the details of the litigation, but there have been two circuit court decisions that have allowed lawsuits to go forward related to greenhouse gas emissions, one on nuisance and one related to damage claims via Hurricane Katrina. You can debate with Chris the merits of the cases, but at least it looks like those cases are going to go forward for more full hearing within the judicial system. Usually when I ask people if they prefer a litigation route, that is usually uncertain and people don't like that route. So people really wouldn't prefer our greenhouse gas emission reduction programs come out of litigation. The regulatory agencies have been very active. I gave you a list of activities both at the state level under the Air Resources Board. They're already fully into reporting. They have a draft cap and trade set of regulations out on the street for people to review. There's companion legislation going on within the state under SB 375, which involves several of our panelists up here today, looking at how better to assign reduction targets for our regional communities and how better to do our land use planning to help achieve some of those goals under the California legislation that's geared toward reduction of statewide greenhouse gas emissions. EPA has been very active in regulation as well. They have several items that have come out. I haven't listed everything that EPA has been up to, but essentially since the Supreme Court ruling in 2007, they've been slowly building the foundation for the regulation of greenhouse gases outside of any new legislation. So they'll be doing it all through the Clean Air Act. They've started with reporting. Entities are going to be reporting in 2011. That's already a regulation that's out there. Recently they just released standards for motor vehicles. So that's a regulation on the street. And many see that as a trigger then of bringing in stationary sources into the Clean Air Act program, set of programs that the EPA has developed for permitting current facilities and new facilities for greenhouse gas emissions. So EPA has really been active in this realm of building the foundation for the regulation of greenhouse gases from a variety of sources that probably impact most people in this room, transportation as well as stationary sources. And my main point of setting the context and why we've assembled this great panel of the regulators here is these rules are developed in a public process. And so it's good to be informed of what the rules are that are being proposed and that there is a public process for you to be involved in that. And with that brief context introduction, I'll turn it over to our first panelist, Henry Hilken, who's the Director of Planning and Research at the Bay Area Air Quality Management District.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation to Bay Planning for the opportunity to talk to you. I'm going to talk today about some of the air quality issues that we're confronting at the Air District, not just with greenhouse gases, but air quality in general, and how transportation is such an important part of the air quality challenges that we're going to be facing moving forward. And it's interesting, you know, we've introduced this panel as a regulatory panel, and the district is a regulatory agency. We have regulatory authority over stationary sources of air pollution, power plants, oil refineries, down to auto body shops and dry cleaners. We do not regulate mobile sources of air pollution. That's done at the state and federal level. And today, motor vehicles, transportation, on-road and off-road, is the main source of air pollution in the region, by far. Whether it's the pollutants that form ozone, whether it's fine particulate matter, whether it's air toxics like diesel exhaust and other air toxics, whether it's greenhouse gases, every pollutant that we confront these days, transportation is our main source. So we continue to look at our rules as we continue to look for emission reductions. We look where we can get some reductions from commercial and industrial sources, and we continue to do that. But that low-hanging fruit is long, long gone. And so more and more, it's clear to us that dealing with transportation and the fact that land use and transportation are so interrelated, dealing with land use is going to be really critical to continuing to make air quality progress in the Bay Area. Our air quality here is pretty good. It's certainly a lot better in Southern California and the Central Valley. We're very fortunate we have the ocean and the Golden Gate. That helps us out a lot. But we still do have some serious challenges. We do still exceed health-based air quality standards several days each year in the summer and winter. And periodically, the state and federal government tighten air quality standards, so the goalpost keeps moving. So we do still need emission reductions to meet health-based air quality standards. A second challenge that we're focusing on a lot these days is more localized air quality impacts. Historically, we've looked more at sort of these regional smog or particulate levels, and we continue to do that, but we're also looking much more now at very localized air quality impacts, high levels of diesel exhaust and other air toxics near roadways, near ports, near rail yards, very localized high exposures. And then thirdly, climate change, the subject of this conference. As was very well illustrated in the morning's keynote speech, we've got a huge challenge in front of us. And so moving forward, it's clear to us to deal with these regional smog issues, these localized air quality issues, or our greenhouse gas challenges, dealing with land use and transportation is going to be critical. We need more land use development, more efficient land use patterns in downtown areas, more mixed use, more infill development to support alternatives to driving alone. I mean, we're not going to eliminate motor vehicles, that's clear, but we can do things through our land use patterns to make it easier to get around for some of our trips by transit, by walking, by cycling. Technology is going to help us get there. We have a very clean vehicle fleet in California. It's not the most energy efficient fleet in the world, but it's probably the cleanest fleet in terms of the air pollution emissions that come out the tailpipe. But we're going to have to look at the way we get around the vehicle trips and vehicle miles traveled to continue to make progress. So we're looking at a lot of different programs at the Air District, to how we basically all the tools in our toolbox to get at that issue. One of the things we're working on right now is our CEQA guidelines, our guidelines for local environmental review processes, to help cities and counties to provide cities some tools, and as they make their land use decisions, to really make the most air quality beneficial decisions they can. And one of the tensions that we're facing and may come up during the Q&A is as we promote this infill development downtown, in many parts of the Bay Area, those are also the areas where we see the highest levels of those localized air pollutants, those diesel exhaust emissions. So one of the challenges for us and the other regional agencies and our dialogue with the cities and counties in the coming years is going to be how do we promote the infill development that we need to get people out of their cars and yet at the same time make sure that we're not putting residential areas, schools, hospitals, sensitive receptors too close to sources of air pollution. And that's where the conversation gets is going to be very challenging, but I think there are solutions. But it's going to be the regional agencies working very closely with cities and counties on making those very fine-grained land use decisions for more sustainable land use pattern. I think I'll stop there and hand it on.
Thank you, Henry. And I think that land use issue goes well into our next speaker, Ted Dropboom from the regional. He's a regional planning program director at ABAG, BAQMD, BCDC, and MTC.
Thank you, Doug. And by the way, when I grow up, I have aspirations for working for all the letters of the alphabet. Could you go to my slide, please? We are limited in this session to one slide, and I tried to actually fit three graphics on this slide, and it didn't work. But there are two graphics, but I'm going to have you imagine, if you will, the graphic that didn't fit. And the graphic that didn't fit is population growth. Over the last 25 years, since about 1985, the Bay Area has grown by about 2 million people, from around 5 million people to 7 million people. We're projected to grow by mid-century, by 2040, 2050 or so, by another 2 million people, to around 9 million people total. Now think of a little bit for a second about what 2 million people is like. 2 million people is around the present population of metropolitan Sacramento. It's around the present population of metropolitan Portland, Oregon, including those folks in Vancouver, Washington. It's like adding another two San Jose's to this region. It is like adding five cities of Oakland to this region. It's a big number. Now, we are one of the slowest growing regions in the state of California. But percentages are not the folks that you provide services to. It's those. It's each one of those 2 million additional people. That's our growth challenge over the next 25 years or so, over the next quarter of a century. Now, simultaneously, with accommodating those 2 million additional people, we are being asked by the state of California for very appropriate reasons to start reducing our transportation impact on climate change, start reducing the greenhouse gases that we emit in this region from automobiles and light trucks. Now, the graph there to the left shows the magnitude of the challenge that we have in this state to reduce our transportation greenhouse gases, CO2 equivalents. We, and this was reconfirmed in the presentation this morning, if we are to avoid the most catastrophic consequences of climate change, we've got to bring our greenhouse gas levels down to about 80% of 1990 levels by mid-century, by 2050. That's that little green slice in the chart to the right. 1990 levels are in that left bar. Where we are projected to be business as usual, if we don't make any drastic changes, is that blue bar above the green bar. That's a huge challenge. Now, most, if we're lucky, most of that challenge will be met by emission standards and things that the federal and state governments do. But that's a huge amount of technological change in a very short period of time. We believe very firmly that there is no one single solution, that there is no silver bullet to reducing our CO2 from transportation, that we're going to have to move on a multitude of fronts. And the state is asking us to move on, essentially on the front of land use patterns, which brings me to the map on the right. And that is CO2 per household in transportation in the year 2006. That shows the power of land use pattern on CO2 emissions. Those dark green areas have about one-third the CO2 emissions per household as those red areas. Those areas that are relatively compact in terms of their development form, where people live close to jobs, where they live close to transit, where they live close to services, where, frankly, driving is a little more expensive because things like parking are more expensive and a lot of people pay bridge tolls and what have you. Those are the places that have much less CO2 per household than, for example, the areas in southern Santa Clara County, where essentially you have to get in your car to buy a loaf of bread. That's a huge difference. So the challenge that we have over the next 25 years or so is to get more of that 2 million population to live in those green areas, or to convert more of those red areas into green areas with land use changes, mixes, and what have you. The difficulty in meeting that challenge is that land use is the responsibility of 109 separate local governments in this region. I work for four powerful regional agencies. None of them has significant land use authority. So the agencies that I work for have to now, and we're prepared to do this, form a partnership, a genuine partnership with those 109 local governments to, in fact, achieve the sorts of changes that will be required over the next quarter century. That's my presentation, Doug.
Thank you, Ted. Our next panelist is LaRonda Bowen, ombudsman from the California Air Resources Board. LaRonda.
Thank you. As the previous speaker said, we were limited to one slide, and while you had a really creative way of getting two complete illustrations on yours, I had to do it with words. So I'm going to actually talk a little bit about, we were asked to say, what is our top priority? And for us, the top priority is keeping the momentum. You heard the speaker earlier at the general session talk about the importance of moving forward. So we're trying to keep that momentum. The Air Resources Board is trying to get us where we need to go, only trying to get us there faster than we would get there without regulation. I don't know what happened on that slide, but it works on mine. And our top challenge may be overcoming myopia. But one of the things that I want to stress is that everything is connected to everything else. So as the speaker just before me said, we need a lot of partnerships. So I was really pleased to learn that I would be invited to speak to this panel because it's about problem solving. And obviously California has a problem. And as the ombudsman, I get to help solve all the problems. So I'm here to ask for your help. But really, as I look at myopia, the question of doing things the same way, not having a bigger vision, that's the key problem I deal with every day and that the Air Resources Board deals with. So if we address climate change, we have to think and act in ways that are unnatural. That is, we have to think today and take action today to solve problems and pay costs today to solve problems that we won't actually see. So I appreciated the speaker earlier today when he was talking about the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. They're the ones that are going to benefit from our action today or pay the price of our inaction today. So our long-term investments are going to, our short-term investments are going to have long-term returns. AB 32, most, anybody here not know what AB 32 is? Okay, good, I won't go there. So as we look for ways to restrain our energy consumption, we look for ways to plan our cities more intelligently. We look for ways to reduce the impacts from transportation through reformulated fuels, through cleaner cars. You guys heard of the Pavli rule. The things that are already in place under AB 32, under our scoping plan, have already achieved or will achieve about 80% of the emissions reductions that we're after when they are all fully implemented. Now, most of them don't start being implemented until 2012, but there's an awful lot of development that's still going on in the regulatory area. So you heard the mention of the cap and trade program. We're looking at how do you reduce emissions under a cap and still not affect the economy in a negative way, but rather incentivize those kinds of technologies and activities that will actually reduce emissions and allow people to still do make the economic decisions they need to. We have efforts underway to reduce emissions from refrigerants. The low carbon fuel standard is still under development. There are a number of areas where we are taking action, but there is an opportunity for people to participate. So for example, our economic analysis for the original scoping plan was criticized for not taking the current economy into consideration, for not doing more scenarios for business as usual, more scenarios for what if things don't work. We updated that, and that'll go back. It's out on the street, actually, for review now, but it'll go back to our board for more comment on April 21st. Trying to keep this with my 5 minutes. Another issue that we talk about here is sustainability. That's the transgenerational equity that we talked about. The things that we start today, whether it's energy conservation or it's other transportation measures, have to be sustainable. They have to be things that are going to have long-term positive effects. And so one of the things that we struggle with today, for example, is as you look at cap and trade, what kind of credit do you give to fuels, for example, biofuels that are not sustainably developed? That is, they're developed using high energy technologies. We want to not do that. The main things that we're trying to accomplish in AB 32 are to change the way that we produce and consume energy, the way that we move ourselves and our goods, and the way that we build and design our roads, buildings, and communities. I do want to clarify that the Air Resources Board is not a land use planning agency. We are not in that business. We're not trying to go there. What we're doing is working with those who are in the planning business and the metropolitan planning organizations to actually set targets. What will the targets be? And then we leave that to the 109 agencies plus more to figure out the how. So in conclusion, I'll say that the future of AB 32, there's a lot of partners at the table. There's a lot of activity at the national level as well as at the state and local level. The regulatory framework or the legal framework for AB 32 is not going to go away. The desire, the need, and the urgency of doing steps today that will reduce our impact on the climate for the future is not going to go away. And so what we really want and need from you is your participation as we try and develop a way forward in this new world.
Thank you. Our last panelist this morning is Ben Mackle. He's a manager in the Clean Energy and Climate Change Office at US EPA Region 9. Ben?
Thanks. So my slide actually doesn't look too different than what Doug started us off with, though actually he had more details, so maybe I should have used his slide instead of my own. But I just want to spend a minute talking about, or a couple of minutes, on policy. This last year, so much has happened with climate change policy development, even outside of what's happening in legislative discussions. So looking at the Clean Air Act and other authorities that are existing, this has been a landmark last 12 months. And also, so policy, but also resources. There's a lot of discussions now about what funding is available. So both, looking at regulations, looking at resources, these are opportunities for you to be very aware of what's going on, but also looking for opportunities collectively, how to engage in that process and make sure, you know, your considerations are taken into account as these huge decisions are being made. So I'll go back again to what Doug talked about a little bit, the endangerment finding that EPA made in December of last year, that greenhouse gases, well, actually, going back earlier, the Supreme Court reminding EPA that, yes, greenhouse gases are pollutants. So with that reminder, we needed to then look and said, okay, these are pollutants. Do they endanger public health? And we did make that finding last December. Six greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. And at the same time that some of those greenhouse gases cause and contribute, greenhouse gases from transportation cause and contribute to climate change. So what does that mean? It means the Clean Air Act is open. The door is now open to regulate greenhouse gases, not just that they'd be pollutants, but they can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And in fact, this month, April 1st, we finalized our first rule, which is the greenhouse gas emission standards for vehicles. So now you're used to the CAFE standards where there's mile per gallon limits. There are now grams of greenhouse gases per mile requirements. So the Clean Air Act, so now we went from greenhouse gases being a pollutant to being a potentially regulated pollutant to now we have rules in effect, it is regulated. So the Clean Air Act all of a sudden has opened up the stationary source provisions, the mobile source, the rest of the Clean Air Act can be used to regulate greenhouse gases, which caused a lot of concern. Hey, the Clean Air Act wasn't necessarily written for greenhouse gases. They're very tight, you know, 100 tons a year, 250 tons a year limits. If you're going to permit every source down to that level, you're going to have the regulated community, the federal agencies, the state agencies doing permits. This is not what we had in mind. So there was a huge amount of concern, and we had draft rules, the tailoring rule, how we're going to tailor the Clean Air Act to permit greenhouse gases. And since that time, our administrators made several statements saying, you know, we're going to do this slower. We're going to do this. No, we're going to permit. The thresholds are going to be much higher. Try to alleviate some of the concerns out there that, you know, this will be done considering reality when we're regulating greenhouse gases, recognizing the differences between our traditional contaminants. So lots of discussion going on now on the rules, what they'll look like. Also related, separate from greenhouse gases and separate from the Clean Air Act, but just this year, North America or the U.S. and Canada became part of the emissions control area, or will go in effect in 2012, but requiring international or ship fleets, the fuel standards to be tighter. So not a greenhouse gas discussion, but another major change has happened just in the last few months. So policy changing quickly. And opportunities. On the West Coast, our Region 9 and 10 office, so all the states, California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Hawaii, work together. We have a West Coast collaborative trying to look at diesel emission reductions. It's also the area, the tool we use to distribute funds for the Diesel Emission Reduction Act. So funds primarily looking at reducing diesel emissions. Here on the West Coast, we give extra points for trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions all at the same time. So we have a funding source that was authorized at $200 million a year nationally. That expires in FY11, so definitely an opportunity to be involved in the reauthorization discussions on the amounts of money. The more money that's available through the federal government is the more money that's available to you to get these improvements with your fleets. But also, not just the dollar amounts, but where the money can be used. The more flexibility there is in using that funding in the next round of reauthorization, you know, the more ability you have to look at broader issues, diesel emission reduction certainly, but other climate change concerns. So a good place to be involved. We also have showcase community grants. This is for cities. It's a $10 million program. Was put into our budget last year. It's there again this year, but it's an opportunity for cities, and the cities can be working with anyone in their community to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So another funding source, and again, these grants are meant to be models for the rest of the country to put together practices that can really help get greenhouse gas reductions. And of course, Department of Energy with the Clean Cities programs, definitely opportunities out there. With the economic stimulus money, there was even more, including for us. But still, annual money out there available to do the types of things you're trying to do and to deal with climate change and broader, the newer generations of issues that plague us today.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Well, I think given the constraints of the speakers, and we ask them to put them what's on top of their minds to try to get that out onto the conversation here, we're going to open up the question and answer session. And just a reminder of how Ellen started the meeting, we really encourage this to be a dialogue, a discussion. To get things rolling, I'll start with a question, but I do encourage people come up as you have questions to stand at the center mic, and we'll just take people in order as they come out. But start it off, so the first question I think I'll field to you, Ted, and maybe Henry can field the secondary part of the discussion. You mentioned how you're coordinating the competing needs of these 109 local governments to develop the sustainable community strategy for the whole Bay Area and how that may help meet challenges under greenhouse gases. But Henry also mentioned the challenges focused on pollutants that may cause health concerns in these communities. So how are you balancing all those competing needs?
Well, we're going to get the local electeds from 109 governments, which is about 700 people, in a single room, and we're going to have one heck of a bun fight. No, seriously, I think it's important to understand that all of this is going to unfold over time. First of all, good local planning practice can help mitigate a number of the concerns that Henry is talking about. Where you locate uses relative to those emitters is important. Which uses get located in what places is important. The use of buffers, the use of filters in projects, all important. It's also important to recognize that over time, many of the sources that Henry is talking about, particularly diesel pollutants, will in fact be cleaned up. Our freeways are going to be cleaner 20 years from now than they are now, because we fully expect there will be significant improvements in good movement technology. We're planning for a region of the future. We have to take some of that into account. And the beautiful thing about cleaning up the diesel trucks and the other emitters on the freeways is not only does that deal with the new people moving into these neighborhoods, it deals with the health of the many more people who already live in those places. Now, I think it's important to realize, too, that we also have some very significant regional cooperation underway in this region already. We have a program called FOCUS, which asked local governments to voluntarily designate places with good transit service within existing communities that were willing to take on more housing growth. By good transit service, we mean rail, ferry, or buses with 20-minute headways. Over 50 of our jurisdictions volunteered so-called priority development areas that met those criteria. Collectively, there are over 120 priority development areas they occupy about 3% of the region's land area. But according to those local governments themselves, those areas will accommodate about 50% of our population growth over the next 25 years. That's a good start on a cooperative effort to deal with this issue.
I agree with Ted. No, he does such a good job coordinating the regional agencies. He knows exactly what I would say. I mean, everything Ted said, I completely agree with. The improvements in the vehicle fleet that Ted mentioned are critically important. The Air Resources Board, as I think most people here know, has adopted a series of rules on various mobile sources, diesel rules, that are extremely important. And so the emissions that I was talking about, some of those local exposures to diesel exhaust, that situation is going to be a lot different 10, 15, 20 years into the future. I will say parenthetically, there is right now a lot of pressure on the Air Resources Board to relax or delay some of those diesel rules, and I want to encourage everybody in this room that they are critically important to public health, and certainly the Air District very much wants to support those ARB rules and see their implementation as quickly as possible. But the point being that areas today that may cause us some concern or at least want us to scratch our heads and look more closely in future years probably would be much less of a concern. The diesel emissions would be much, much lower. And then secondly, as Ted said, it requires more careful planning. The work that we've done to identify areas in the region that are affected by air toxics is done at a regional level. We have air quality models that we've gone down to a 1 kilometer grid square that's extremely detailed for a region as huge as the Bay Area. But for the local land use decisions that Oakland or Berkeley or San Francisco or Walnut Creek is going to make, 1 kilometer is really not that helpful. So one of the things that we can bring to the discussion is providing much more local modeling tools. So when cities are looking at the general plans, looking at the folks at the priority development areas that Ted mentioned, we can do much more localized air quality modeling and look really at a much finer grain of detail. Which one of those priority development areas are probably fine and really don't pose those conflicts? And let's not talk about that anymore. Let's do everything we can to get political and economic support for development in those areas. Where there may be areas where there is this concern, that's where we have to seriously look at setbacks, buffers, even project phasing. Phase a project so you don't have residential development for a few years until the fleet is cleaner. The concerns that I've raised are not, I don't think, are a deal breaker, but it does require more careful analysis and, in some situations, very careful planning and site planning to make sure that you're not putting those people, exposing them to high levels of air pollution.
Thank you, Henry. I do encourage people to come up. I'll throw out another question, but please come up to the mic with any questions you may have and participate in the dialogue with the panelists. But LaRonda, I know there's been a lot of activity on the federal level, as Ben went into detail, and especially in regard to their legislative path or their regulatory path under the Clean Air Act, and legislation-wise, a lot of talk on the in Congress about cap and trade. Is any of this affecting the way ARB or direction they may be going, or are they incorporating any of those elements into ARB's current thinking? And then to get Ben involved in the dialogue, maybe after LaRonda's finished, is EPA looking at anything that ARB is doing as part of its forward look on where it may take greenhouse gas regulations?
Thanks for setting us up in direct conflict. We did not have a chance to talk about any of this. The federal process as it moves forward is certainly something that the Air Resources Board is looking at. We intend in the cap and trade program to harmonize our program with whatever the EPA does or whatever the federal legislation turns out to be, whatever ends up in the final Waxman-Markey as it moves through the legislative process. That said, we're also not waiting for that action before we move forward. So the cap and trade program that we have under design now is an opportunity for everyone in this room to become involved. It's something that we want to make work, and we recognize that the various elements, and there are so many moving parts if you think of it that way, all have to work together. And it can't just be a California-only program or there's not enough market. So we have the Western Climate Initiative and different partners that we're working with. But we'll definitely, part of our design is definitely to include whatever we can to harmonize our program with the federal program.
Yeah, I don't think this turned out to be a very contentious question, so you have to come up with a different one. But we have a couple of examples of where California's gone first and the federal government has played a role, or at least have been in the discussions to just to think about, well, what happens if this goes national? And one is with a mandatory reporting rule. California is already doing that. Actually, this is our first year of reporting at the federal level, but there's definitely was discussions with California, but even with the voluntary registries, just how to coordinate efforts to make this burden as minimal as possible on those that need to do the reporting. So definitely discussions happened earlier on, even before we had our rules in place or had decided, you know, what would be elements of our programs. But then on the cap and trade side, you know, we've only been talking about the Clean Air Act so far, the regulatory side of how we would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, cap and trade, we need to look at federal legislation. We need to look at what's not there now. So it's really hard to you know, compare notebooks on what a program could look like at the federal level. But that said, we did have an EPA person on the Market Advisory Committee that ARB put together under AB 32 that has experience with cap and trade programs under our acid rain program. So we definitely gave the perspective of, well, if this does go national, you know, this is what we've done in the past, or this is what we would need to do that may or may not be what California would need to do for a state program. So it's definitely been dialogue all along, but without legislation saying this is what a cap and trade program needs to look at a federal level, you know, we're both, you know, can't be too sure what the final design would be, that where there would be, you know, a harmonized program and where there might be differences.
All right, thank you. Question.
Also seem to coincide with some of the warmer climates, and so.
Sorry,
like
I didn't hear that last.
Okay, so my question was, on the map that you showed that where there were some red zones where there's higher vehicle miles traveled. It also seems to coincide with the warmer areas. And so I wonder how much percentage of the carbon footprint is related to energy efficiency of buildings and, you know, what incentives or grants could be, programs could be put out there to encourage buildings to either retrofit or to build with white roofs or different types of lighting and that kinds of thing.
What we showed in that map were CO2 related to vehicles only. There is a significant correlation, however, between those areas and other aspects of climate efficiency. In the Bay Area, we have about a 1 degree temperature gradient per mile as we move inland from the bay. So to the extent that we can move residential location closer into the bay, we significantly reduce the need for space cooling. You significantly reduce the need for water for irrigation and what have you as you move closer to the bay. And one of the highest consumers of energy in the state of California is moving water around. So you've got that co-benefit. Compact development with party walls and less surface exposed is also more energy efficient. So there's a whole bunch of co-benefits that come from that more compact, denser, I use the D word, denser development around the bay.
Thank you.
There's one of the problems that we face is we need an economy to actually support the changes that we need to make, the investments that we need to make. And there is a concern that maybe the regulatory fervor gets ahead of the economy's ability to support changes. For instance, the clean truck program that has been implemented in the major ports in California is predicated on the truckers either retrofitting their trucks or buying new post-2007 trucks, which have cleaner emissions systems. However, we're in the worst economy we've seen since the Great Depression, and many of these drivers cannot afford, under this current situation, to make those changes. And there isn't enough, as we've seen recently here in Oakland even, enough public money available to help them get there. So what you face is a seemingly intractable CARB deadline that they must be retrofitted by such and such a date, but the economic conditions don't support at least a broad sector of them being able to make those changes. Granted, there has been some recent flexibility shown by CARB, but for a long time there was not, and there still is not enough public money. Can anybody say Proposition 1B, which was supposed to allocate $1 billion towards these cleanups in port areas? A lot of that money, I don't know where it went, but it's not all available for things like green cold ironing and truck cleanup. So I just want the panel to address that question. And I have one other point, and that is you show this map with the outer outlying areas in red where there's going to be a lot of growth, and yet we face a constraint on our infrastructure. You have four mainline BART routes converging on one track at West Oakland to get into San Francisco, where a lot of the jobs are. And basically, at peak commute, that line is maxed out. So we're talking about the need to make massive infrastructure investments in order to pick up, in terms of a mass commute, soak up some of that growth and that pressure on clean air systems. And I wonder if you could just address the economy and the infrastructure elements. Thank you.
I'll start with the truck issue. You're right. The economy has been in quite a slump. I'm glad that it's getting better. I work a lot with small businesses and certainly a lot with the truckers. What we found when we started the regulation on the truck and bus rule and also on the diesel risk reduction plan, which was not an AB 32 rule, but it ends up helping us there as well. Of course, when that rule was first being debated and passed, the diesel risk reduction plan, we didn't foresee this economy. That's correct. But we did allocate quite a bit of money for the various ports through the different programs, including in Southern California, for example, the port put a container fee on some of and helped to fund actually the trucks at the Long Beach and LA ports. In Oakland, that didn't happen for a variety of reasons, and we did face a situation where quite a few truckers, I can't remember the number now, but I think it was either 1,200 or 1,600, at the end of the period of time when they were to have applied for the funds, either had applied and been rejected or the money had run out. And so you are aware the governor made available additional funds. I'm glad to say to you that most of the truckers that came in, we did extend the time for those trucks to get retrofits, and we extended the time for the retrofit manufacturers to actually get the work done. So most of those truckers did get funding. They did not get 100% funding, but they're also looking at at increased volume because some truckers decided not to apply or felt they couldn't apply or were not qualified to apply for funding. So the truck, it's a difficult situation. But the good news is that most of the truckers that applied for funding did get some of the help, and they are expecting to generate enough revenue to not only pay for those, but actually increase their business. So we're getting a lot of heat for the extensions that we gave from the truck drivers who did apply and comply on time, because they're looking for that added revenue. So I hope that addresses your question.
On the infrastructure issue specifically, a lot of people believe that the Transbay Tube is in fact a significant infrastructure constraint. Ultimately, it will be, but the constraint that we hit before the Transbay Tube, in an area where we can do some capacity improvements, albeit expensive, which would greatly extend the capacity of BART, is not the tube itself, but the platform capacity on the San Francisco stations. And that is, in fact, the one of the prime capital improvements that BART is looking at. The other thing to notice, and this is, you know, it's hard enough to think about adding housing for 2 million people. But one of the things we should be thinking about a region as a region too is our employment distribution. Most of those trains that go into San Francisco in the morning return out to Richmond and Walnut Creek and Concord half empty or even less empty in the morning. If we can begin to distribute employment to sub-regional centers outside the city of San Francisco, tough thing to do. If we can get more people working in downtown Oakland, if we can get more people working in Walnut Creek or downtown Richmond, downtown Berkeley, then in fact you've actually extended the capacity of your BART system, and you've also made BART financially more sustainable than it is presently.
I think we had another question back there. Right?
Yeah, my name is Justin Simeon. I'm an ecologist at WRA, and in that role I've become familiar with a number of scientific studies that have come out over the past few years demonstrating the ability of ecological habitats to sequester carbon. And so as we're talking about these regulations, I was wondering if there is any role that is foreseen within them for a carbon banking using ecological habitats.
Well, I'll start that one. At the federal level, again, it goes back to what legislation would we have in effect, because there would likely be offset provisions in there, and it would talk about what types of projects would be eligible for offsets. So at the federal level, there isn't a program in place that can define that. There are definitely voluntary registries out there and offset protocols that allow for even different agricultural practices, conservation tillage. And so there's things out there that may serve as models, but at the federal level, you know, we don't have that in place. And I know the state, you know, you can answer for ARB, but it's also a work in progress right now.
That's right. It is a work in progress. The forest protocol is probably the closest thing, and it's just everything is under development. So I just have to echo what you just said. There are the voluntary registries out there, but nothing is established yet.
LaRonda, you had mentioned earlier, over here, sorry.
Talking.
You had mentioned earlier during your presentation about the use of incentives to help people make these changes and implement the regs, and you talked a little bit about with the trucking industry and the ports. I was just wondering if you could discuss a little bit incentives that CARB has in place and ones that they're considering in place in the future to help people make these changes.
The question is about incentives. Well, the Carl Moyer funding is one incentive program that we have, but Prop 1B funds. There are, I should have to look now a list. There are, we have awards, we have partnerships, we look for opportunities with the California Energy Commission in particular. We work with the utilities to help find funding for construction, for housing, for a variety of ways of reducing energy consumption. So in the areas where we are working, we look for ways to I'm just being reminded, AB 118 funding. There's a variety of incentive programs, and I guess if you go on, if you want a list of them, I can get that for you. But there are a variety of them.
I would just add that the Air District, there are regional incentive programs too. The Carl Moore program and the Prop 1B monies that LaRonda talked about are often programmed through the regional air districts. So, and we, in addition to those, the Moyer program and the programs that LaRonda mentioned, we also have the Transportation Fund for Clean Air, which is a surcharge on vehicle registration fees. So the Air District administers each year $50 to $80 million worth of incentive funds for diesel retrofits and other clean air projects. I will say, I'll point out, those are by state law, are for surplus emission reductions. So those are for projects that go beyond state regulations. So going beyond compliance or early compliance with state regs, we don't use taxpayer money to have people comply with the law. But for exceeding or early compliance, there is quite a bit of money at the regional level for to help those projects.
Can I throw out one more point? It's not all gloom and doom when we're talking about how we're going to transition to this economy or being more carbon efficient. Much of the things that we can do and that we're all starting off doing is looking at efficiency, whether it be energy efficiency in buildings or fuel efficiency on the roads. So it's still a transition. There are still things that we need to deal with to get to become more efficient. But in doing that, we're saving money. And a good example is the new vehicle emission standards that EPA just put forward this month. It does cost more to build those vehicles. So there will be a burden on an upfront burden on paying slightly more for your vehicle. But you get that back in fuel savings quickly. So, yes, there will be a burden for us to face, but a lot of the things that we can be spending our time doing in this initial period is trying to break down those barriers to efficiency, making sure the people burdened with paying those additional costs are somehow getting some of the savings that go along with it.
And not to belabor the point, but one thing that I don't hear us discussing here is actually the economic opportunity that exists in this transition period. I mean, there's an awful lot of business that's being done. There are opportunities. We get visitors from all over the world and from all across the country looking for ways to aggressively pursue the new markets that are developing. So, you know, we're trying to keep this short, but don't overlook the opportunities. And particularly, I want the business community, and especially the small and mid-sized businesses, to work with us. We're trying to put together a group right now to actually identify more of these opportunities and find ways to get our own businesses participating in them, so it's not just always coming to others.
Just to add to the list of potential incentives, MTC will be announcing probably within the next week or two a climate innovation grant program for innovations in the transportation sector.
And I think we have time for one more question, which is in the back corner.
Okay, thank you. Incentives are great, but what I want to ask you about is support. I'm currently in the marine permitting, but I was in multi-use residential commercial permitting for 10 years. During that time, 7 of those years was spent promoting a poster child of a transit-oriented development in a local Bay Area community. And the paralysis happened at CEQA. The company that I work for spent millions and millions of dollars processing their CEQA documents and going through public processes, public comment, but the paralysis happens that local governments do not understand the details and the information that goes into those documents and basically could not stand up to public scrutiny. As a professional in the industry, we knew we'd covered all our bases. But the councils could not approve it to the satisfaction of their community. They could not stand up and say to their own community, guess what? These people went through the process correctly. They did everything we asked them to. They've answered all your questions. It's time to approve this transit-oriented development so that our economy can thrive and we can get going. If we can have those units and those commercial businesses close to public transportation, water and bus, everything. As I said, it's a poster child. So I sound a little emotionally irritated because I am. I respect what you're doing, and I'm in your arena. But if the local councils can't tell their community members and their constituents that the people bringing business to their community and residents residential units in their community to reduce emissions in a transit-oriented development, and they're going to approve it. How do we get here? How do we get to what you want? If one of you would come to the council meeting or write a letter to the council and say, this is it. This is that focus project. This is it. We want this. Guess what? We'd have more. Can you free up somebody in your offices?
Well, let me take a crack at that one. You know, CEQA has had very important environmental benefits, and you're quite right. It is often misused also. There's no question about it. It can be used as a club to kill projects, often for reasons that have nothing to do with environmental impacts. You're absolutely right. But one of the things that we're hoping to do through these guidelines is not just provide another club to project opponents, but actually try and help and provide some certainty to cities. So, for instance, we're proposing in these new CEQA guidelines that I mentioned briefly, greenhouse gas thresholds. We haven't had greenhouse gas thresholds in the past. No air district has up until recently. Some air districts are starting to move in that direction. Well, that's put a lot of lead agencies around the state in serious problems. There have been a series of projects and plans throughout the state that have been challenged legally. The Attorney General's Office has challenged various environmental impact reports, and environmental groups, the Center for Biological Diversity, principally among them, have challenged EIRs. Orange County, San Bernardino County, Stockton, there have been a series around the state that have been challenged for not dealing with greenhouse gases, and those have been upheld. So what we've tried to do is, as we've developed these thresholds, is develop greenhouse gas thresholds that are based on state law, on AB 32, on the scoping plan, and we've worked very closely with the Attorney General's office and with the Center for Biological Diversity, and the main litigants support our thresholds. So we're hoping that rather than just putting another roadblock in the way of infill development, that this can provide some certainty. Here is a benchmark. The State Office of Planning and Research has said, yes, CEQA, you should deal with greenhouse gases. We're not recommending a threshold. We recommend you work with your local air district as you do that. We have support from the main litigants. So we're hopeful that that provides some safe harbor, some legal defensibility in those CEQA challenges. And on the support, you're quite right. That I think that will be important, and that's something that we would probably talk at the regional agencies. I think we have to do to not just oppose bad projects, but I think taking a public position supporting good projects is very important. You're absolutely right.
And on that note, I think we've run out of time for our part of the panel discussion here in this session. And I want to thank the audience for a great set of questions to our panelists, and the panelists for participating in this dialogue during this session. All of us except Ben has a flight to catch, so he won't be able to make the end session. But if you have burning questions left for these folks, remember, we'll still be around and back for the last 10 minutes of the session to help answer questions as well. And with that, I think we have a five-minute changeover. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Looks like on the slide, we'll have plenty of questions from the audience. Yeah, I think so.
All right, I think we're ready to get back underway. Good morning again. My name is Chris Locke with Ferrella, Braun, and Martell, and I'm pleased to be moderating this panel, providing an industry perspective and the discussion of the challenges and solutions and strategies posed by carbon management and climate change. I think from everything we've heard today and everything we know, climate change and carbon management pose an environmental challenge of really global proportions more than any other environmental challenge we've dealt with in history. And as the prior panel and Dr. Flick discussed earlier today, the issue has gone largely from what was a scientific debate to more of a government imperative. We've seen... If I could have the first slide, please. We've seen state legislation, with California leading the way as usual with AB 32 and other related bills on cap and trade, of course, in the implementation phase, but it's on the books, and it was the first state to do so in the United States. And I think we all thought we would see the Obama administration following suit with similar federal legislation, but as Doug and some of the earlier panelists said, that doesn't appear to be immediately on the horizon. And in fact, in addition to the Waxman bill that's been pending for some time, we're seeing a new initiative by Senators Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman to perhaps have a softened bill that would only apply initially to certain industries, that would even perhaps preempt certain state laws by federal legislation. So I think it's going to be a while before the federal government sorts that out, particularly following on the heels as it does to the healthcare debate that we've seen in the last few months. We have panelists from several sectors of the economy to talk about the technical and economic challenges and the political challenges that are posed for private industry in seeking to strategically plan for what's on the horizon, not in addition to figure out how to implement it. And we've also, as Doug mentioned earlier, In the context, the backdrop of all of this is litigation, as always. The Massachusetts versus EPA lawsuit was mentioned earlier, finding that that EPA was required to regulate greenhouse gases as a pollutant, leading to the endangerment finding. But beyond that, we've also seen all kinds of other litigation related to climate change, including a relatively recent lawsuit by 16 states challenging EPA's regulation of greenhouse gases, not California, of course, and private lawsuits. And Doug touched on this as well, but just to add an additional layer of complexity, we have lawsuits like one that was pending here in the Northern District of California, the Kivalina lawsuit against oil refiners and other energy producers, claiming that emissions caused by them constituted a public nuisance that had led to the warming and eventual melting of a natural seawall around the Kivalina village in Alaska, which required relocation of that village at a cost in the nine figures, which, by the way, was a cost estimated by the Army Corps of Engineers following their analysis that relocation was required. It's a public nuisance lawsuit by environmental groups. That suit was dismissed by Judge Armstrong last fall, but it's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit and two other federal courts of appeals, the Second Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, have looked at similar lawsuits and overturned the dismissal, finding that these are actionable claims. So we'll see what happens in the Ninth Circuit. We'll see if there's a conflict that goes to the Supreme Court. So there is huge complexity in not only the legislative realm, but also the regulatory realm, and now added to all of this, disputes on all sides of the equation by environmental groups, states, and others in litigation. Obviously, although the scientific debate may be largely over, the technical, economic, and political questions are far from settled. It's my pleasure to introduce a very distinguished panel, which is going to be led off by Joe Sperano. He has graciously come in to replace Lynn Westfall, originally on the schedule. Joe is the former president and the current executive advisor of the Western States Petroleum Association, and very appropriately is also formerly with Tesoro. So, Joe, with that.
Thank you, Chris. I am pleased to step in and help out my good friend Lynn Westfall and my friends at Tesoro, and try to make a few observations this morning, and maybe some of them will be provocative. I will stop short of trying to provoke you to throw things because I don't want you to hurt me. But other than that, let me start by making a couple of what I think are overarching comments. And first, that the reduction of greenhouse gases is a worthy goal. I think it stands repeating on a regular basis. There also are risks. And some of them relate to California pushing ahead and maybe going it alone, and it's not clear yet how that's going to turn out. Also, this is a big deal, and from an industry and government, regulator perspective, citizens of California, we have to get this right. There's way too much at stake to not do it, and as a result, you see an enormous amount of effort being put into getting it right by all parties. Unrealistic time frames for accomplishing goals are something that we as an industry are concerned about, limiting industries from using market mechanisms to their fullest extent is a concern, and we hope not a recipe.